I'm Ron Barr, and welcome to this special U.S. Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. Sports Byline is America's sports talk show and heard on more than 200 U.S. radio stations, Sirius XM satellite radio, as well as worldwide on the Internet and the more than 500 stations of the American Forces Radio Network. On this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, we talk baseball with Marlins catcher John Baker, who considers himself lucky to be in the majors. Mary Carrillo will join us to talk about her work as a broadcaster, a reporter on the highly acclaimed HBO show Real Sports, and her career as an athlete. And we'll also catch up with noted sports broadcast historian Kurt Smith and talk to him about his latest book about the legendary broadcaster for the Dodgers, Vin Scully. So sit back and enjoy this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. First up, Florida Marlins catcher John Baker. Baker overcame great odds to make it to the major leagues. He never caught in high school and nearly gave up on baseball. He played his college ball at the University of California, and after being drafted by the Oakland A's, he stalled in the A's organization at the AAA level. He was traded to the Marlins, where they brought him up to the big league club, and he's now in his third year. In the offseason, he became the first major league player to visit the troops in Kuwait and Iraq. As we began our conversation, I asked him if the hat that he was wearing saying "just scrap" sums up his career.
Absolutely. I think it definitely sums up me. It's from there's a Hawaiian fighter in the UFC, a guy by the name of BJ Penn, and that's always been his motto. He's the 155-pound MMA champion of the world. And I saw the hat. I saw a shirt that he wore one time when he came in for an entrance into a fight. And it's funny that you hit it on the head like that, but I've always been somebody who has kind of had to scrap for everything. You know, I didn't get a college scholarship. I was drafted pretty high by the Oakland A's, but behind another catcher who was, you know, one of the main subjects of Moneyball. So I was always kind of on the back burner, always somebody who had to, move up based on performance alone. You know, nobody really ever handed me anything when it came to baseball.
Fair to say you're an overachiever?
Oh, I would definitely say so. Yeah, I'll tell you right now, I'm not the best athlete anybody's ever seen. I've always strived to be the best player that I can be, that John Baker can be. And I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons I really appreciate the game of baseball, because in no other sport can you, the three major sports we have in America, baseball, football, basketball, you know, not considering golf or soccer, but baseball, football, basketball, or what we associate the most, I think, with the United States. And when you look at those sports, you know, no amount of training can make you 7 foot tall. No amount of training, I mean, you can improve as an athlete, but no amount of training is going to make you Patrick Willis. It just doesn't happen. I think that Patrick Willis is a natural, great athlete with great instincts already. I don't have that kind of stuff. And I think that, you know, I was a guy who was lucky enough to have great parents that helped me put school first. They gave me the opportunity to go to Cal, and then that opportunity, you know, led to baseball. And I always applied the things that I learned about schoolwork, about how to study, how to prepare towards sports. And because of that, I was always, you know, pretty reasonably successful. And I would say more successful than I should be.
What is it about your character that's allowed you to endure against the odds?
You know, I think it has more to do with my parents and my upbringing than anything. You know, I watched my dad's a CPA, played a little bit of professional baseball himself in the Phillies organization, and I watched how hard he's worked in his life to make things for his kids. And I look at his father, I look at my grandfather, somebody who, you know, worked for the phone company for 50 years and didn't take days off, and really grinded things out so that his children could have better opportunities. And I think that, you know, when you see some of the things that other people go through, and you realize that what you're going through isn't that bad, you know. As tough as it is to play minor league baseball and to, you know, wake up at 3 a.m. and get on an airplane and fly across the country and play a game that night and not make a lot of money, you're still playing baseball. And I think that we forget to see that sometimes. And you know, I look at I can remember when I got traded or when I got claimed off of waivers by the Marlins the first time in 2005, and the A's had taken me off the roster. And I went back and I said, you know, there's people at Chevron now that are losing their jobs. And as much as I want to complain about maybe not being on a 40-man roster or not making a ton of money, you know, I have a job, number one. And number two, I'm happy with my life and with my family. So I think that, you know, having something at home, you know, having a wonderful wife and family support system to be able to go back to in the off seasons makes it easier for somebody to really try to push for their dreams and their goals.
Being 28 years old when you finally made it to the major leagues, is that that's generally considered a late age, is it not?
Yeah, I think so. It's not. I don't think it's that common, and it just took me a while. You know, I think baseball there's the opportunities are few and far between, and there's so many players. You know, every year we have 50 rounds where we draft, another 1,500 guys, and so the influx of talent is so high and so fast, and you're competing on this world stage, and so you have to have somebody that likes you, you have to have somebody willing to take a chance, you have to have the right injury situation, and opportunities are so few and far between. I mean, I can tell you right now that I can probably count off 20 players that I know that are better players than me in every aspect of baseball that have never played baseball in the major leagues. And it's just because of the limited opportunity there is. You know, baseball is still kind of an old boys club, and it matters who likes you, what opinions they have of you, and it's a very difficult sport to change those opinions because you can get written off very fast. He's a bad defensive player. He can't hit when the pressure's on. He can't do this. He can't do that. But how do you really know until you see somebody try to do it at the major league level? And I think that I really owe a lot to the Marlins because they gave me that opportunity. Yeah, it took three injuries, but once they gave me the opportunity to play, they saw that I could do it. They didn't take me out of the lineup, and even when I struggled a little bit to start. And so to get those opportunities is really important in baseball.
How important also is first impressions? Because what tends to happen in sports, no matter what the sport is, John, I think you know, is that you get labeled. You know, you can't run a 4.4 40 in football, or you don't have a strong arm. Does that happen to a point that it can almost ruin a person's career before they even get there?
Yeah, I think so. I think that sometimes you look at baseball players, and I think sometimes the front office looks at baseball players and immediately puts absolutes towards them instead of, you know, letting them work it out in their career. And the hardest thing in baseball is that we tend to the major league personnel tends to trust people that have played major league baseball over people that haven't. And so what happens is that you see a lot, if somebody is a guy like me that's on the fence of, well, maybe he could do it, maybe he can't do it, we don't really know, as opposed to, you know, a hot prospect that they're going to call up in September regardless of what kind of season that he has because, you know, they gave him $4 million or $3 million in the draft. But when it comes to a player like me, if you have somebody like me at my point in the career where hadn't played Major League Baseball yet, had made the All-Star team in AAA, and they kind of say, so what, about stuff like that. And then another guy who maybe wasn't having the same kind of year, but 3 years ago had been up in the big leagues with somebody else and didn't panic. And they know that when they put him in the game, he's not going to have a freak out. You know, they don't know that about some baseball players. So until you either have that opportunity or you have a positive label that pushes you through a minor league system, it can be very difficult just to kind of break through.
I'm going to make a comment here, and if I'm wrong about it, please correct me. I think that one of the important things for you to make it to the major leagues is the word balance. I think you've stayed balanced. And the problem with athletes, if they go 0 for 3, they worry about it, and they get too low. If they go 3 for 3, they get too high and don't have that balance. Now, you had to scrap along the way, and I think the only thing that really saved you and probably gave you the opportunity to have a major league career is that you were balanced. Am I correct?
Absolutely. I think that you have to learn early on to be able to compartmentalize things and be able to say, okay, when I go to the ballpark, I'm a baseball player when I walk into the locker room. And then when I walk out of the locker room, I'm no longer a baseball player. I'm a husband. I'm a son. I'm a brother. You know, you're different things to different people. And so that helped, you know, that compartmentalization. But then also we learned, and for as long as I spent in the minor leagues, I wouldn't trade it for anything else because, you know, the relationships I made, the friends that I made, I mean, those are still the real friends in my life. The people that I spent time with in college and the people I played a lot of minor league baseball with, those are my real friends. But you have to learn that, and Oakland did a fantastic job of drilling this into us. Keith Lippman, especially the farm director there, talked a lot about no ups and downs. You're always the same. You know, you have to be able to separate yourself. And if you can do that, it starts from that stage when you walk in the locker room. If you're the baseball player when you're on the field and you're the human being when you go home, it's going to be a lot easier to adjust to the 4-for-4s compared to the 0-for-4s. And when you can walk out of the locker room every day with the same kind of feeling, that's when you've been successful with your approach.
You never caught in high school and nearly gave up on baseball coming out of De La Salle. And Cal recruited you as a hitter when you showed off a fairly strong arm. And then you were handed a catcher's gear and told to figure it out.
Well, yeah, I mean, no, yeah, I don't want to put Dave Esker in a bad light, but we didn't have a catching instructor my first year there. And so that's kind of basically what happened. Dave Lawn, who after that he was the pitching coach at USC for a couple of years, but he was our catching guy. He was a left-handed pitcher, and we didn't really have somebody who was schooled in how to train a catcher to you know, somebody, especially somebody who never caught. So they kind of told me to go watch Mike Tonis, who was the starter. I said, hey, watch what Tonis does. Excellent defensive catcher. Got called up to the big leagues in 2004 with the Kansas City Royals, strictly for defense. And they told me, hey, you know, go watch him. He knows what he's doing. And I just kind of watched him. But, you know, I learned later in life from my current catching instructor, Tim Cousins, that everybody's different, you know, physically. So things that Pudge Rodriguez can do, I can't do those things physically. So I have to figure out my way of doing stuff. And so, on the field, the first time I ever caught in a real organized game that wasn't like a, you know, a high school summer league game because somebody got hurt was when I was in the Cape Cod League. Scott Pickler, the head coach of the YD Red Sox, you know, gave me the opportunity to play baseball there. Somebody got hurt. I got an opportunity. One of the guy's arms hurt. They put me behind the plate, and I caught like 35 games after that. And, you know, you need opportunities like that, and it was just a strange situation because it's not a position that you usually just pick up later in life.
We've got John Baker with us in the studio, the Florida Marlins catcher. Let me ask you about the catching position, because when I take a look at it, it's more than just catching the ball and throwing a guy out at second base. It's really a strategic position. And when you take a look at guys that have been, I think of Mike Socia with the Angels that went on and became a successful manager. A lot of catchers went on and became that because I think they managed the game when they were on the field. Was that the hardest thing for you to pick up in that position?
Yeah, I think so. I think some of the physical stuff was difficult for me as well, but I would say to in a generalization, I think the hardest thing for most people to pick up is the gamesmanship part of being a catcher, the field general part, the quarterback part. You have a lot of responsibility because, you know, my main goal, and I would say more so than throwing somebody out or receiving every pitch and making it look perfect or blocking every ball. My main goal is to put the pitchers in a position where they can see a sign and just let their body do what it's supposed to do and throw a pitch and not have to think about how they want to pitch somebody or the strategy. I mean, we do have some great guys on our team that, you know, are into that kind of stuff, that want to be part of the meetings, that want to be in there and watch the video with me. But, you know, I put a lot of time in, and I think every catcher should. And I learned this from Jason Kendall, from talking to Jason Kendall, who's one of the best at it in baseball. You have to put your time in and do your homework and be prepared. I mean, we have all this video available to us, all these resources, all these scouting reports. We have this thing called the Inside Edge, which is a great scouting report. What somebody's doing in their last 15 at bats, what pitches they're swinging at. You know, we have a computer system where I can type in Chase Utley, right-handed pitcher, and I can watch his last 15 at bats against right-handed pitcher. What is he swinging and missing at? What's he putting in play? Where were the pitches that he was hitting? And so I spend a lot of time in the video room studying, you know, like school. And it's a skill that I learned from school, and I write some stuff down. And then last year, in the past 2 years, I'd go over it with our pitching coach before the game, and then we would present that information to our pitcher just so kind of he knew, hey, this guy knows what he's talking about. You know, his signs are he's going to put signs down to put you in the best possible position to be successful. And once you do that, and then the pitcher can just do all the things that he needs to do physically and not worry so much about exactly what he's going to throw at what time, I think you have the best recipe for success.
What about the trust that has to be developed between catcher and pitcher of you managing, calling the pitches that you think will be effective, and especially if you got a young pitcher out there, because they can tend to be emotional and overthrow the ball and everything. How long did that take you to get that trust with them?
I think it happened pretty fast for me at the major league level, because I think, you know, it actually I'll never forget something Scott Olsen said to me in the first game I ever caught in the big leagues. You know, he's 5 years younger than me. And I get called up, and he has a fantastic game. You know, eight innings, one run. That was the first game I ever caught. And the only run he gave up was a home run to Scott Harrison. We were playing at Petco Park. And after the game, we're being interviewed. And Frank Ford, who's the, you know, the local guy for Fox Sports there, who does our post-game interviews on the field, he calls me over, and Scott Olsen's there. And he asks Ole, he says, hey, you know, what was it like throwing to a rookie catcher, somebody who doesn't know the hitters? And he looks at him, and he goes, rookie catcher? He goes, this guy's been in baseball longer than I have. You know, I saw that he was prepared, and he talked to Mark about it, and he's going to remember it better than I'm going to remember it. And so he put a sign down, and I just threw it, and I was successful. And I think that, you know, I was lucky enough to come up with a team that had a young pitching staff that I could work with, and then we had some veteran guys sprinkled in that could help me when I needed help. We had Arthur Rhodes. We had Kevin Gregg. These are two guys. We had a guy named Joe Nelson who's from the Bay Area, from went to St. Joe's. And these are three guys where if I ever had a question, I could go to them and say, hey, I'm not so sure about Derek Lee, about how we're going to pitch him. You know, the scouting report says this, but when I watch this, I see this. And they would say, well, you know, you might see this, but this is really what's going on. And then I could relay that to the younger pitchers, and those guys, you know, they trusted me, you know, fairly quickly. And so it was nothing but a positive experience for me working with them.
Let me switch gears and talk a little bit about the minor league experience, because you did travel around a lot in the minor leagues. I think when you say minor leagues, a lot of people think of Bull Durham, the movie. How similar is it to that? And what were the minor league? What was that minor league experience like for you?
Well, when it comes to the lower levels of the minor leagues, you could not have made a more accurate representation of it than Bull Durham. I mean, it's right on. Long bus trips, different personalities, you know, funny little locker rooms that smell weird. You know, little small towns. You know, you go to Battle Creek, Michigan. You go to let's see, Beloit, Wisconsin, and play in front of 9 people, and so you see some different things, but yeah, it's a great learning experience, and I think that, you know, you have to learn how to get along with all kinds of different people. That's the first thing that you notice, and then you have to realize that, you know, despite how your game went that day, and this is I think the biggest lesson that you learn in the minor leagues, you're going to play another one tomorrow, and when we talked earlier about maintaining a level head and staying even keel the entire time and maintaining balance in your life, that's the number one lesson. The most important thing you learn in the minor leagues is that no matter how you do on Wednesday, on Thursday, the lights are going to turn on again and you're going to play another baseball game. And as soon as you can, you know, realize that and not take things so seriously and realize that you're playing baseball and have a good time, the experience is a lot more fun.
One of the things that I've always said about young athletes, and it may apply to other sports, maybe in basketball or even professional football, is they may be a star at one level. But when you go to the next level, you've got to reprove yourself all over again. Now, it may be a little bit different, John, in the fact that you've got rookies or young players coming in that have been given a $3 or $4 million bonus just to sign. Is the attitude different among those players that, you know, have already been handed a lot of money?
Some of them, and some of them, yes, some of them, no. You know, there was guys I played with like for example, two guys that strike a chord right off the bat, Joe Blanton, Nick Swisher. Okay, both guys that were first round picks, given, you know, $1.5 million out of college and told how fantastic they were. But both guys that came in and worked hard and, you know, made it a point to try to act like everybody else. It's almost like when you have one guy that gets a lot of money and then you have 30 guys that don't. That one guy is now in the minority and he's got to prove to the other guys that, hey, just because he got a bunch of money doesn't mean he's any different. You know, and those two guys really took that to heart. And I think that's why they're successful big leaguers. Because, you know, yes, they were good players and they were talented players. But they also put the time and put the hard work in. I think it was my first instructional league. They gave Nick Swisher the lunchbox award. And the Oakland A's did, because of how much time he spent extra in the cage, how much time he spent in the weight room, and all the hard work that he put in. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of a difference, I think. Some people are looked at differently. And then you also see the other guys, the prima donnas that are, you know, you give an 18-year-old $1 million and he goes and buys an Escalade and he thinks he's hot stuff and he hasn't done anything in baseball, you know, but played high school.
One of the things that I remember, and I did not play professional baseball, but I used to visit my grandparents in Parkersburg, West Virginia, and we'd play American Legion ball and travel all over the state of West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania as well. And we'd go into Whitesville, West Virginia, where the lights were on telephone poles, and if it ever got hit above the the lights, you had to run to the to the dugout because you were going to get hit with the ball. We were playing a game up in St. Mary's, and Paul Popovich, who caught for the Chicago Cubs, was a catcher on that team, and I'm pitching. I come in the 10th inning in relief, and I come in, and the fog rolls off of the Ohio River. Now, I assume a situation in which there is two outs, and there's a guy on first base when they bring me out of the bullpen, and so I'm pitching to this guy. In comes the fog, John. You couldn't see anything, and all I heard my first baseman say is, he's going, and he ended up at third base.
Oh, no.
Did you have moments like that? Are there stories that when you sit back and you think about the minor league experience that you had that you just kind of smile a little bit about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're usually the negative stories for me individually that you laugh about, but I can remember Adam Schorcher was a catcher that played at San Jose State. And played against him in college, and we both got drafted the same year. And he was in He was with the Padres, so he was in Eugene, Oregon, and I was playing in Vancouver, British Columbia with the A's in the short season, Vancouver Canadians. We come down and play them, and one of my first games of professional baseball, we've got runner on first base, runner on second base. Guy goes to steal. I pop up to throw the ball to third, and I throw it right off the guy's helmet, and the guy scores. Okay, so I'm thinking I'm already feeling bad about myself, and then the next guy walks. Base hit. Now we got first and second. And Adam Schorcher was the guy hitting the head the first at bat. Now we got first and second. And so the guy takes off for third again. And sure enough, I pop up and throw the second ball off the second guy's head. And I definitely had some moments like that. I can remember having a game in the Arizona Fall League. And this is one I'll never forget because my family was there. My in-laws were there before we were married. And they came up to see me play. And we're playing a night game at Scottsdale Stadium. And first four at bats, I strike out. So I've started the game 0-for-4, 4 strikeouts, and I get up for my fifth at bat, runner on first base and one out. You know, we're up by one, and it's a pretty close game towards the end of the game. And I'm thinking to myself, God, just put it in play. You know, nobody wants to strike out 4 times, 3 times, you know, let alone 5 times. And so I put the first pitch I see in play and hit a ground ball to second base and hit into a double play. So I'm at this point I'm 0-for-5 with 4 strikeouts and I made 6 outs. We go into the bottom of the 9th inning, and I get crossed up by Houston Street and get hit right in the forehead with a fastball when I think it's a slider. Ball bounces to the backstop. The guy almost scores, but we end up pulling the game out. And so, you know when you can walk away from the ballpark after a day like that with a smile on your face, you know that you are level-headed and even keel. And that was, those are two memories for me that I'll never forget, you know, about how low can you go, how bad can it be, and you're still okay. You know, your family still cares about you despite the fact that you might feel like as an athlete that you really embarrass the hell out of everybody.
John, when you think about being in the major league, what is the one thing that excites you more than anything else when you put on that uniform?
I think it's just that. I think it's putting the uniform on. You know, when you're a little kid, when I was a little kid, that's what I wanted to do. When I realized that, you know, baseball was the sport that I preferred the most, you know, your next logical step is, as a kid growing up for me, I wanted to be Will Clark. I wanted to play first base for the Giants and wear number 22 and have that kind of a swing. You know, I just loved watching him play. I loved watching him swing the bat. And so, you know, for me, when I got drafted, that was very exciting. You know, playing baseball professionally was exciting, but getting called up and putting a major league uniform on and walking out and hearing the national anthem is about as exciting as it gets. You know, I think that the physical stuff, the actual part of playing the game is a lot of fun. But when it comes to the basic emotions of what's going on, just being able to stand there in a major league uniform on a major league baseball field was all that I ever wanted.
Is it hard to be a pro athlete today? We hear about the problems they have off the court, off the field, the image that they might have, and it's only a small percentage of them. And I think everybody else gets painted with that brush. But, you know, when do you hear things coming out of the stands, whether you're on the road against another team or even when you're, you know, in your own home stadium?
Well, have you ever been to Philadelphia?
Yeah.
Okay. Then you know what goes on, and especially in our division. We play in Philadelphia and New York, and so you hear a lot of things. But, you know, I really feel like, you know, I'm never somebody that's going to fall into the typecast athlete, you know, the stuff that we see of you know, guys driving all kinds of fancy cars and spending a lot of money. That's just not who I am. You know, and I haven't made, you know, all kinds of money in baseball. I'll tell you that. You know, when you're making $1,500 a month, you know, riding a bus through West Texas, you know, you learn how to save. And so that's kind of how I've been these first 2 years of my career. But, you know, you hear a lot of stuff, and the way that I feel about it, too, I'll tell you what, I've heard some pretty nasty things coming out of the stands, especially in Philadelphia. And you learn right away that, hey, you know what, when you sit back and look at it, these are the people that are paying our salary. And if you're going to pay, you know, $100 to sit right behind the dugout, then by all means, you can tell me whatever you want to tell me. You know, I know enough not to take it personally. And I enjoy it. You know, I think that Barry Bonds has one of the best quotes about Dodger Stadium in the history of baseball. He said, you know, you have to be pretty good to have 55,000 people telling you suck.
Let me switch gears here on you in a moment. I talked about this before we took the last break, and that is about your trip to Kuwait and also to Iraq. And no major league player had been to Iraq since the U.S. invasion in 2003 until you and Chris Coughlin, the National League Rookie of the Year, your manager, and some other people from the Marlins went. And you said a lot of us take for granted what goes on overseas and the sacrifices these soldiers make. So what better way to say thank you to them It's the least that I could do. What did you expect that experience to be before you got there?
Yeah, I really didn't have anything to compare it to. I couldn't really expect anything. You know, I didn't know if we were going to be scared, if we were going to be in danger. You know, they've sold it to us that we were going to be very safe, I think, and that's what you got to tell somebody if they're going to go over there. But I didn't really have any expectations. You know, I think that I had two cousins that served. My cousin Shane McCabe was in the first part of OIF and reenlisted and went back, and he was in the Marine Corps, Staff Sergeant of the Marine Corps. And so, you know, when they would come home, I would try to respect, you know, how I wanted to be respected. When I come home from the season, the last thing you really want to do is sit down and talk to your family about baseball. You know, you've been living it for 8 months. And when they came home, you know, the last thing I wanted to do when I saw them was say, hey, how was the war? You know, because it's just an ignorant thing to ask someone. And I'm sure that that's not what they want to talk about when they're back from over there. So, you know, unfortunately for me, that didn't give me a lot of insight into what goes on. And so I didn't have a lot of expectations, but I can tell you that, of what I thought it was going to be, being there and coming home, my expectations were exceeded exponentially.
What's the first thing that surprised you about the experience?
You know, honestly, the first base that we went to was RF John in Kuwait, and, you know, seeing how it's amazing, I'd say, and I'm sure you experienced the same thing, but there's an overwhelming sense of selflessness and teamwork that is, it's a hard thing for me to explain. You know, I play a team sport and I've been playing a team sport my entire life. But that being said, the stakes are nowhere near what they are over there. You know, you have to rely on the man next to you or the woman next to you with your life. And so every person we talked to always said, hey, you know, what you're doing here, it's really great for these men and women. You know, you're really raising their morale. You know, you never did you hear somebody say, hey, it means a lot to me. You've really helped me out. You know, no, everybody's fine over there, right? When you talk to them, everybody's fine. But everybody else that's in their unit or in their platoon, they're really happy that you're here, you know? And so that was really cool to see that kind of selflessness. And I think that it's a lesson that I'm going to take away and put towards how I'm going to live my life in the future.
Well, what one memory, if there is one, that you took away from that whole experience?
Oh, man, I think that as far as a single moment that I can really remember, you know, we were at a small forward operating base on the Iran-Iraq border. And there was only about, I want to say, maybe 100 guys over there. There was no women on base, only about 100 guys. And they'd been there for 11 months, and they hadn't seen anybody else. And the reception that we received from them, it was like when we were leaving, they were trying to like hold on to our pants to not let us go because it was, you know, such a break of monotony. But their job was interesting because they stand at the entrance to the border, and less than a foot away from them are their sworn enemies, Iranian soldiers, and we're the sworn enemy of Iran, according to them. And the Iranian soldiers stand there, and the Iranian soldiers stand there holding an AK-47, and our soldiers standing there holding his M4, and some of these guys are 19, 20 years old, and you know, the ability to them to have to look in somebody else's eyes for 4 hours while you both hold a weapon and, you know, keep composed and be able to go home and go to sleep at night was just an amazing display of fortitude, in my opinion, because I think after a while, you know, you'd be wanting somebody to flinch so that something happened. And then, you know, part of what else they did was they have a guy in a guard tower staring at the Iranian sniper with a sniper rifle, and just having to stand there with tension in the air and nothing happening for 11 months. I just can't imagine how hard it was for them to have to deal with that every single day, and what a relief it's going to be when they go home. And so, you know, with that being said, they would always tell me, people would always say, hey, when I get out of here, I'm going to do this. And when I go home, I'm going to do that. And it really hit me when we were there at that little tiny base. It really hit me that you know, when I get out of here, I'm getting out of here in 3 days and I will be home. You know, and I do have the opportunity to do the things that I want to do and spend the time with my family and see things that I want to see in our country. And so, like I said, it gives you another, it gives you a little bit of a spark to get out there and do things that you maybe haven't thought about doing before.
We got about a minute left, but when you walk away from this game the last time, A, will it be hard? And two, what will you do in the next life?
You know what? I don't know.
are you going to be one of those they have to rip the uniform off of?
No, I don't think so. You know, I love what I do. I think I love it more. I love it the most for the relationships that I've made and the people that I've met. And I think that's the most important thing about team sports. You know, you go to battle with these guys and you get out on the field and you're willing to fight for them and do whatever it takes to try to win a ball game. And I think that's a lot of fun. I mean, and that's a great part. But it's the stuff in the locker room, I think, that I'm going to miss when I'm done. You know, the constant jabbing back and forth, picking on each other, arguing and making up and going out to dinner and that kind of stuff. That's the stuff I think that I'm going to miss the most. And, you know, I really feel like whatever I decide to do after baseball, I know one thing that I plan on doing is going back to Berkeley and finishing school, because I think that would make my mother happy. And that's something that I want to do myself, you know, individually. But I think that with the relationships that I've made, there'll be something that I'll be able to find to do when I'm done with this that is both, you know, fulfilling, and it's something that will help me, you know, continue to raise my family and support my family.
Marlins catcher John Baker, happy to be in the big leagues and glad he could bring some happiness to the soldiers in Kuwait and Iraq. Mary Carrillo has had an extraordinary career as an athlete and a broadcaster. A former pro tennis player, she's now one of the top network TV tennis analysts. She broadcast the Vancouver Winter Olympics for NBC, has produced groundbreaking documentaries, and is a featured reporter on HBO's award-winning show, Real Sports. I asked Carrillo, given all she's accomplished, what impresses her the most?
Just that I've been able to have the opportunity to do so many different things. That has been the biggest blessing. Obviously, I started out just doing tennis on TV, and just women's tennis, and then it moved to men's tennis, and then it moved to other sports, and by then I wasn't just in love with tennis anymore. I really liked television, and being able to just tell stories in any sport. You know, I've done 8 Olympics now, and I've I'm working on my 5th documentary for HBO Sports on Ted Williams, which is absolutely fascinating to me. I've gotten to do some writing. I've gotten to travel the world. So I never imagined something like that could happen. When I was a professional tennis player, the job I currently have really didn't exist for women, and now it does.
What is it about your background that gives you the approach and the philosophy you have about talking about sports or reporting on it?
Well, I'm only fluent, Ron, in one sport. The only sport I truly feel like I can watch and know what I'm looking at is tennis. But I'm a jock, and I love athletes, and I love the athletic heart, and I like every kind of sport, and I'm very curious, and I think that's really what has allowed me to jump around and again just sort of tell stories about any kind of sport.
Let me lend this observation, and if I'm wrong about it, please correct me. I really think, because as I watch your work, this is what comes across to me as a viewer. And that is that you're interested in the story, not just the competitive story, but the life story that goes along with the athlete. It's one of the things that I've always been fascinated in, and I don't think you need to know how to hit a 95-mile-an-hour fastball to understand the challenges that maybe an athlete had to get to where they are.
I think that's just right. That's how I feel about it. And, you know, if you like sports, if you like the immediacy of it and the unpredictability of it, and if you have ever tried, especially to play the sport that you can be watching on TV or at a ball field, and you know what it takes, and you know how hard it is to reproduce excellence over and over again, you know, under extreme pressure, then that's what compels someone like me to follow sports. And you know, look, that most athletes are young, you know, they're in the prime of their athletic life, you know, they've got, you know, they are at the height of their powers, and they are just throwing it all down on there. And you know that there's a very limited lifespan to how long they can try to live out their dreams. And all of that just conspires to make it such an important moment. You know, even a sport I don't know about, I'm in, you know, because I understand what we're looking at here. I understand, you know. I was talking, my daughter, I have a 17-year-old daughter and a 21-year-old son, but my daughter was in the car with me, and I was giving an interview the other day, and this reporter was asking me who I thought was going to win the upcoming French Open. And he was talking about a bunch of teenagers. And I was explaining, well, this one is this, and this one is that. This one's feeling the pressure. This one's still maybe loose enough to make a dent and make it into the second week, and this. And when I was all done, my 17-year-old daughter said to me, Do you know how odd, how strange it is to listen to somebody your age talk about somebody my age and say that they could win, like, a major tennis championship? I'm very lucky that I have, you know, I have the benefit of these reality checks, too. You know, I've got a couple of kids around me who are the age of the athletes I'm reporting on. And, boy, let me tell you, that's a nice thing to have around.
Mary, what have you found as you take a look at the decades and the eras of sports? Because you have been around for a long period of time.
I'm old. Is that what you're trying to say?
No matter whether it's tennis, because reporting on HBO Sports, Real Sports, you certainly have talked about and interviewed other athletes of other sports. Well, yeah. But what's the commonality that transports itself from one generation of athlete to another, no matter what the sport might be?
Well, I mean, for me, it's every athlete seeks excellence in his time. You know, I'm working on a documentary on Ted Williams, and all that man ever wanted to be was the greatest hitter who ever lived. And you know, you can make an argument that he still is. You know, the last man to hit 400 was Ted Williams. You know, so he was of a very special generation, a very special moment in time. But I'm watching now in my own sport of tennis, Roger Federer. You know, so many of us thought, boy, this guy is going to be the greatest tennis player who ever lived. But these days, when you look at what's happened in tennis, Rafa Nadal has pretty much dominated the rivalry between himself and Roger Federer. And so how can Roger Federer be the greatest player of all time if he's not the greatest player of his time? So if you're asking me what is the common thread, the commonality, I think the most you can ask of any athlete is that they try to, you know, play their best ball and do as well as they can in their time. And if you can say that about them, then all the arguments about equipment changes and he was on steroids and he wasn't and all that stuff kind of goes out the window. If you do the best you can do in your time, I mean, those are the athletes I get to watch and talk about and report on. And that's what's exciting. And almost, I mean, you know this as well as I do, with every generation there are improvements, there are changes, there are technology changes, there are so many things that kind of skew things, you know, that kind of, well, wait a minute, you have to take that into account. And let's keep in mind that when Ted Williams was playing, Satchel Paige wasn't allowed to play in his league. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There are just so many, that's why there are so many barroom debates about sports, because you can always throw in things, you know. You can always say, well, wait a minute, but he didn't play it when that happened, and they were playing with a different ball, and the mound was higher, the mound was lower. It never ends, which is also kind of fun, too. But in the end, the quest for excellence is a common thread in sports, and that's what I most admire and respect.
One of the things that I've found in talking to all the great athletes, the commonality, whether it be a Michael Jordan, a Billie Jean King, or even Pete Sampras, is that those athletes that are truly great love being able to determine the outcome
Yes.
of their competitive sport. And I know Michael Jordan said, and I've used this many times on the air, that when the game is on the line, I want to be the one to determine the outcome. If I succeed, I'll take the glory. If I fail, I'll take the blame. And not everybody is comfortable
No.
with the fear of failure.
No, I love that quote, too. But that was the essence of Michael Jordan, wasn't it? The
mm-hmm.
clock, you know, the clock is ticking down, and he's there, give me the ball. Give me the ball. And it takes a very special athlete to want that ball at that time instead of dishing off. And he was like a lot of my favorite athletes had that mentality, you know, like this. When it really counts, you know, give me the ball. That is, that's a classic quote.
It really is, and I know in talking to him, I asked him one time, I said, "Will you know when to walk away from basketball?" And he said, "Absolutely." He says, "I'll put the basketball down on the court and walk away the first day I don't enjoy playing this game." And it's very amazing to think of athletes, and I think of the great ones. It's often hard for them to walk away.
No kidding.
Yeah, when you've talked to them, what is the hardest thing for the athlete in making that decision whether to move on in their life?
Well, it's, you know, that's the classic. Wasn't that the classic Joe DiMaggio quote
right.
when he walked away and said, "I'm not Joe DiMaggio anymore." Oh man, but I mean that is when do you get off the dance floor? I mean, the fact is that Michael Jordan, did he really have a clean out when you look back at it? Didn't he play for the Washington Wizards for a while?
And right.
He missed it. I see what I have found with athletes, especially in a sport like mine, where you're not part of a team in tennis. You get to decide if you want to play on or not. You get to decide when it's time to leave. You know, you're not going to get to cut. You have to cut yourself. And I have seen players like John McEnroe never, he's 50 years old. He turned 50 in February. That guy has never retired. Because he hated the sound that those words would be coming out of his mouth. there have been so many tennis. Boris Becker said he was going to retire, won Wimbledon. And then within a couple of months, he was back. And you've seen that a lot. Pete Sampras now is playing senior tennis because, you know what they miss? Not only do they miss the life, but they miss the lifestyle. They miss being, they miss going from city to city and lighting up a crowd and playing for something on the line. And, athletes, let's face it, it's hard to go from all of that kind of glory to settling down, wife and kids, carpools. I think a lot of them miss the lifestyle as much as the competition and the pressure and the glory. It's nice bouncing around and being a big guy in a city, and moving around. And that's why I think a lot of guys hang around.
And I also think that, as Sugar Ray Leonard told me one time, he said boxers, who are notorious for coming back and staying too long in their sport, he says, we're like fire horses. Once we hear the bell, he says, we're ready to go out to the fire. Mary Carrillo has joined us on Sports Byline. You probably see her as a reporter, correspondent on Real Sports. Frank DeFord and I have had many a conversation about that show. Armin Kantayan and I did the same thing. I love the program, and I think it's because it taps into that human spirit that we talked about. Now, you've done a lot of stories. The ones that still stay with you maybe weeks or months after you've done them, what are some of your favorites, Mary?
Well, the one that has meant the most to me was about the Hoyts, a father and son who do the Boston Marathon and triathlons, and the son is in a wheelchair, and
right.
he can't even move. And the father decided he wanted his son to have a full, rich life. The son loves sports, and so he has run a bunch of marathons, super triathlons, all that kind of stuff with his son in the chair. And that's the kind of stuff I like. Those kind of stories. Real Sports does every kind of story, paper trail stories about scandals and profiles of big celebrities. But I think what we do really well on that show are the smaller, quieter stories that you may not hear about that really express the human spirit and the athletic spirit. And those are the kind of stories I tend to get, and those are the ones I really enjoy.
One of the things that I've found along that way, and I agree with you, is that it removes the cynicism from me, and
yes.
I think a lot of people. Because when we look at big-time sports today, what we do hear about is cheating athletes, meaning cheating on their wives or cheating on the sport with steroids and all of that. And it's hard not to get cynical. But when you take a look at the real-life competitive stories, and even athletes, because it's not fair to paint them all with that black brush. There's a lot of athletes that are doing a lot of good things. I think when you do those type of stories, all of a sudden it puts you in a perspective that makes you say, hey, wait a minute, I can't judge everything on the first thing I see.
Well, that's just right. And that's what Real Sports tries to show, that there are all manner of sports stories out there and all kinds of people. And, yeah, there's plenty of bet. Look, the show has won a bunch of Emmys, revealing things and exposing things, and so they can do that kind of the hard news stuff, the real hardcore journalism. But the other side of that are the stories that inspire, that let you know that if there are people out there who just want to play, they just want to play, and even though they may not have a level playing field, they want to be out there anyway. And those Frank DeFord and I tend to get those kind of stories. the show tends to send those our way. Maybe we're just softies or something. Frank is he's a brilliant writer and just a very fine, gentle fellow. And he understands the heartbeat of stories like that.
I don't know that there are very many people around that have covered as many Olympics as you have, and so therefore you've been able to see the kind of evolving aspects of the Olympics today. When you take a look at the Olympic competition, how do you see it
and how has it evolved?
It's, wow, that's, you know, I think the interesting thing in something like track and field, you know, there have been more exposed athletes to steroids and the like in track and field. Well, maybe that's true it's true more of the Tour de France guys as well now as well.